Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
Osiris.
Welcome to Wheels Off, a show about the messy reality of the creative life. I'm Rhett Miller. That's when it got wheels off. Started up and we ain't gonna stop. Oh, she made me feel like a god. That's when it got wheels off. Juliana Hatfield is an indie rock icon. She's been musically active since the mid-80s. She's been in numerous bands, Blake Babies notably early on. She played in the Lemonheads for a while. The Juliana Hatfield 3 has been active on and off since, hell, 30 years ago, as long as my band Old 97s has been. She is someone that I've always heard about but have never met, and I'm so glad that Wheels Off gave me the opportunity to connect with her because I found the conversation to be really illuminating and deep and sweet. She's a thoughtful, vulnerable person. You will hear us reference a couple of points later in the interview that we agreed early on or beforehand not to have the video turned on our Zoom. So it was just a conversation. There was no visual element. And it was great. I really loved getting to talk to Juliana and hear about her journey. A lot of the way she approaches this job surprised me. And I'm really glad once again that I get to do these interviews because I feel like I get so much out of it. I learn so much and I wind up feeling so much inspiration. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to Wheels Off the great Juliana Hatfield. Welcome to Wheels Off, Juliana Hatfield. Thank you so much for joining me. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for inviting me.
For the edification of our listening audience, from where are you logging in?
I am in Amherst, Massachusetts right now.
Nice.
I'm spending some time out here.
Nice. I was there recently visiting old Charles Thompson of the Pixies.
Oh, yeah. He's right in Amherst, I hear, right?
Yep, he is. It's a great town, apparently.
Yeah, I don't know it all that well, but it's nice to get away from the city for a while. I've been in Cambridge for like close to 20 years.
So let's see. Congrats on the new record, by the way. I don't think this will air by the time it has already come out, so it will have already been released into the world. Mm-hmm. Well done, bravo. Brava.
Thank you. Thanks.
But I know, I imagine just from what I know about you that there's probably already a next thing in your mind. Is there any creative project you're working on at the moment and how does it light you up?
There is. I am working on a new album of originals. And it's been kind of, I'm doing it at home, starting at home. And my concept was, well, I'm not a very conceptual person, but it was going to be an acoustic album with no drums. But now as I've started to get the songs together, I'm thinking that some of them might want some drums and some bass. So probably not going to turn out to be the vision I was thinking it might be. But, you know, you have to let the songs do what they want to do and go where they want to go.
Well, I love that you put it like that, because it comes up a lot, and it's one of my favorite ways to think of songwriting is the listening to the song and letting it tell you what it wants.
Yeah, it's you really. I just feel like when I start to try to control a concept, it ends up going bad. You know, if you're or having trying to be rigid about an idea, it often just the idea becomes a weak idea if you're not letting it develop its own self. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you start to really just like impose rigid boundaries on an idea, ideas don't like that. I mean, there are ideas and then there are ideas. You know, if you have a great idea, you can let it come into itself. But you know, it's got some kind of boundaries, but they can be loose. You know.
Yeah. Do you feel like you ever get stuck in the mode of trying to whatever the demoitis version is of as you're making an album? Like you hear it in your head and then you can't let go of it. Are you really good about letting it lead you?
I'm actually pretty good at letting stuff go. There's sometimes a period where I'm like holding on really tight and I'm like, no, you're not, it's not right. Keep pounding it and pounding it. But then I can let go. I've gotten really good at it. And in fact, with this Juliana Hadfield Sings ELO album, there were a few songs that I started working on and I recorded versions of, and I had to eventually dump those early versions of them, start over completely. It happened with Strange Magic, Don't Bring Me Down, and something else. They did my original plans for the songs were not happening. They just were not like working out. And it was hard to let them go, but I did. And I started over and they worked out okay in the end, the new versions.
It's funny, there's a lot of stories of the abandoned albums, you know, in artists' catalog. Is that something you've had in your career where you abandon albums or songs or change your mind midstream?
Yeah, I mean, I can't think of one major event, but definitely that has happened with a lot of songs or even ideas for songs like lyrical ideas or a title or something. I have an idea to write about a subject, and then even that can be abandoned. So, and this probably happens to you. You write a song. I don't know how you write exactly, but if you write a song on a guitar and you're playing it and singing it with an acoustic guitar and you think it's going to be the greatest, you're going to record it with, you know, you're going to do it up with drums, bass, whatever, keyboards, more guitars, and you think it's going to be the greatest song, it's going to be a hit, it's going to be so good, and then you start recording it and it's really disappointing. But then there are other songs that you think are throwaways and you're like, I'll just record it, we might need a B-side or something, and then that is the song that becomes spectacular once you start adding on to it, and it just becomes a total surprise. It just starts to bloom in a way that you never anticipated. Does that happen to you?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. There was a song, we did two albums with a guy that I think you probably know because he's a Boston guy, Wally Gagel.
Oh, yeah. I've worked with Wally. Golly. I've worked with Golly. Golly Wagel. It's great. Love Wally.
But yeah, we had a record that we were in the midst of, and I had just written a song, and he walked by and heard me playing it and set up a mic and recorded it. And then that version of just me playing it for the first time for him is on the album. And it still to this day feels very unfinished to me, but it's our most spun song on Spotify.
Which song is that?
It's a song called Question. It's a little like wedding proposal ditty.
I have to go listen to that. when we're done. But yeah, sometimes it takes outside ears to hear what we can't hear in our own song. You know, someone will hear, recognize something that we can't see yet. And at that, you know, what you were just saying reminds me of this. I was watching last night an interview with a pretty recent interview on a podcast with Andy Summers of The Police. Sure. And he was saying that when they were recording they were starting to record Every Breath You Take, and I think they were in Montserrat at that point. And no one was really into it. They weren't thinking that that was going to be a good song, and I think they were thinking of like maybe not putting it on the album. And that's funny. That's funny because now I think that's one of the or possibly the most played songs ever in the history of recorded music.
You know what's crazy is I had Stuart Copeland on this very discussion series. The word podcast always grosses me out a little. But Stuart Copeland told that exact story, and I think that the deal was they were going to bail out on it, and they'd given Andy Summers you got 2 hours to save this song, come up with something, and he came up with that guitar part that arpeggiated, muted, which is hilarious because imagine bailing out on the song that was going to pay for generational wealth for your family.
I know, but I totally understand it because I've experienced that, not on the level of and Every Breath You Take, but I've experienced the same sort of situation in the studio where you don't appreciate the future greatness of a song's beginnings and vice versa. But I guess after Andy Summers played that part, he said that everyone in the studio applauded because it was like he I think he did it, probably did it in a take or two, and it was just like it was just right. It worked.
Isn't that crazy? It saved
the song.
Yeah, he's pretty good at guitar, turns out.
He's all right, yeah.
I had to turn my camera back on the photo of me staring. It was freaking me out more than... So I wonder about the earliest days for you of music. And was there, when you were a little kid, did you always know this was going to be it, that it was going to be music? Do you remember an epiphany moment? Is there an origin story where you gave up on science and started? I wonder where it became clear to you that this was going to be your calling.
It became clear pretty early on, but during the early part of my childhood, there were other things that I was interested in and contemplating. When I was a child, I wanted to be a cartoonist at times, and then I wanted to be I always played music. I took piano lessons from an early age, and then I got an acoustic guitar when I was 9 years old, and so music was always a part of my life. But I was thinking more of a maybe, I want to be a writer, I want to be a cartoonist. And then it was later, I think in high school, when I started to really discover a lot of stuff like The Replacements and X and early REM, and I started learning those songs, and I realized like, wow, this can actually be done. Like, music isn't magic. I mean, it is magic, but it can actually be played by me. And yeah, so I think it was high school when I felt that shift in me, like, I have to do this. This is what I have to do with my life. I'm doing it no matter what. Music. I'm going to find a band. That's what I'm going to do.
The compulsion.
Yeah, compulsion. Exactly. That's what it was.
Forgive me for not knowing. Was there higher learning in your? Did you go on to like matriculate to college and do all that stuff, or did you?
I did. I went to Boston University right after high school. I knew I wanted to start a band, but I was really very very shy, pathologically shy, and I was very new. I think I just started playing. I might not even have had an electric guitar at that point, but or I had just started playing electric guitar and I was, figuring out how to play an electric guitar as opposed to an acoustic guitar. And I didn't, I wanted to play music, but I wasn't sure how to get there. So I applied to a couple of Ivy League schools. Harvard is one. I didn't get in. I got into Boston University, which seemed like a kind of well-rounded liberal arts school, and I would just go there, and then I'd try to find people to play a band with. So I went to BU, and I was really miserable, had no idea how to connect with people musically, like-minded people. I was really, really depressed. And so during that first semester of liberal arts at BU, that's when I decided I have to go to Berklee. I got to go to Berklee College of Music. That's because if I'm surrounded by musicians, I'm more likely to find people that I can play in a band with. So I applied to Berklee and I got in, and I transferred for that second semester of that year. And that's how I met John and Frida, who became my bandmates in the Blake Babies, because John Strome was a student there and Frida was at Berklee, and Frida was his girlfriend, and she was learning to play drums. And so that's how it all started when I went to Berklee. And oh, and then I eventually ended up graduating from Berklee in 4 years after, and John dropped out after a couple of years, I think, which a lot of people do once they start gigging.
Yeah.
You know, that the goal is to actually work in music, and he quit. But my dad really wanted me to have a degree. He didn't really care where, and he was paying for Berklee, and I kind of saw it through to the end, partly for him and partly just because I like to finish things that I start. And so, yeah, I have a degree from Berklee College of Music.
That's pretty funny. Yeah, I always wondered about that, the Berklee thing, because it seems like it's such a hardcore, like, music theory type of school. And yet there have been a handful of, like, real rock and rollers that come out of there. Do you feel like it's something you had to fight against, the education you got, or did it really add to, you know, your intuitional kind of approach to songwriting and rock and roll?
Well, I think my instincts were so strong, and my disapproval of authority in general were, you know, those things helped me to be able to hold on to my own unique vision, which, you know, I was rejecting a lot of what the Berklee was trying to show me in terms of songwriting. But, you know, I took a contemporary, I think it was like called pop songwriting or something, and I was like, this is so stupid. Like, are they teaching us stuff that's so obvious, you know, which is so instinctual. But the other stuff, like the theory, the ear training, learning how to, you know, write a horn chart, a lot of that stuff was, although it was a lot tedious sometimes and I hated it, I think it was really good for me. And the ear training was great, and the solfège, like having to be able to identify all the notes in a five-fingered chord, or having to do a lot of, you know, identifying intervals, that all really helped me. It was like another language that I never had, and it's like gives you shortcuts for when you are working in a space with other musicians. It's like, it's, or in, even with yourself, it's like shortcuts so you can kind of navigate music in another broader kind of a way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. It's hard to talk to other musicians, and
yeah,
and, you know, and usually you're saying something like, oh, but it's got to be gloomier or whatever, more blue, or, you know.
No, but that stuff still, that's all totally valid language also. And I do a lot of that also, you know, like I think I took from Berklee what I could use, and I forgot or rejected what I didn't like or I thought was useless. And so I took bits and pieces of it and of the education, and I rejected a lot of it. And
like the pop music writing, songwriting classes.
Well, it was just stuff like that was like, I already know that. If you're a listener, or if you're a student of pop music on your own out in the world, you're going to know the stuff already that they're trying to teach you. Like, oh, like go higher in the chorus, you know, like bring the melody up higher, stuff like that. like, oh, that's what a brilliant idea. Or also on the other side, a lot of the there's this There was, you know, it was a long time ago when I was at Berklee, but the idea was they wanted to produce well-rounded musicians who could work out in the world in a variety of situations and genres. So they want to get you comfortable playing or singing in different types of music. And I thought all that was kind of, that wasn't really what I wanted to do. Like I didn't really want to learn how to sing Broadway show tunes or how to play. I don't know. What's another, I didn't really want to play jazz or R&B or genre. There was genre categories. I didn't want to be able to just like, I didn't want to be in a wedding band or something, which is fine for lots of other people, but I knew I had a vision and I didn't want to just be, have facility in every genre. I didn't need that. I just wanted to do my own thing.
Sure. It's funny. It's almost like, and you strike me as very much, I think of my favorite musicians are approach it very in a very workmanlike sort of way, and it seems like you, just hearing you describe music and knowing your catalog, it seems like you do that to an extent, but you don't want to be just like a worker in music, like, oh, punch the clock, like you're an artist, or you've always had that approach, right?
Well, thank you. Yes, I mean, I like to think of myself, sometimes certain parts of my job seem like slog, you know, like when you're on the road sometimes, like, oh god, I want to do this tonight, I don't want to play the song again. But yeah, even that, even being on the road, it's like there's a satisfaction in just like, I forget what I can say. So artistry, I am kind of I guess quixotic or something. Like I'm probably too artistic about it sometimes, and I don't want to do the parts of my job that I don't want to do, and I don't do them, and maybe that has hurt my career in some ways, or I don't know. I don't know what I'm saying.
No, I may be asking you this because you know, the ups and downs of our job are, you know, it's a tricky job. It doesn't offer a lot in the way of security and predictable income and all that stuff. Have you ever over the years thought about like, man, maybe I should do this other thing as not as a way of giving up, but this is not a question I normally ask people, and maybe it's shining a light on my own moment of like, God, I just got off a long tour and I'm tired. Do you ever think like, God, what if I did this other job now instead?
I have thought about that, but then I think, what can I do? You know, the more time goes by, the more I realize who's going to hire me to do anything, you know? But I look at it. I've always thought about that, because every time I leave for a tour, I'm so riddled with anxiety just about all the things that have, you know, you're uprooting your life, you're leaving everything. If you have a dog, you know, you're leaving your dog. It's just so stressful, and having to, you know, move around, perform every night, and I always think, at the beginning of every tour, I can't do this, and then I end up doing it, and it's fine. But for me, when I would think about stopping that and getting a job, a day job, I would think of people who went to an office every day, a cozy little office. I would envy them. I would think like, how nice would it be to just, you know, ride my bike half a mile or a mile down the street, get some kind of job. I could work in an office at Harvard or something. I could be a copywriter, a copy editor, which to me seems like kind of a dream job.
Yeah.
I did harbor dreams of getting some kind of copy editing certificate, if there's such a thing. But then I always end up thinking, I want to make another album. And that's another thing. After every album, I think, I have no other ideas. I'm done. I've said everything I ever want to say. I'm done. I got to get a job. But then I end up having more ideas and wanting to make another album.
What about cartoon? Is there a word, cartoonistry? What about cartoons?
Yeah, I draw a lot, and I think what it is that it's like with music. When I decided to do it, I was so all in and so obsessed, and like you said, it was a compulsion. And I think the only way I was able to have the courage to do it was to have these blinders on and to go at it with almost a delusionary confidence or something. And because I felt I had so much against me in terms of my lack of skills. I was brand new at electric guitar, and I was so shy and not a front person and all this other stuff. But so when I think about, you know, going, maybe trying to sell some of my, I don't know, cartoons or anything, it just seems a little bit daunting because I don't have the blinders on anymore. I think with age, you realize all your worldview just kind of, you open up and you see the reality of everything. And I think, and I in a weird way, I have less confidence now than I used to when I had fewer skills. I don't know if I'm making any sense.
Yeah.
Plus at the age, you know, in my 50s, it's kind of, you realize you're in the older section of the workforce, you know, will anyone hire me? But yeah, with cartoons and with artwork, it's a whole different thing. So I think I have to be a little bit more, work a little bit harder if I'm going to try to make a go at anything like that. I have to have more obsession about getting the stuff to people, because the obsession with me now is with the work itself, and it's not so much getting it out into the world.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm glad you're doing music. I wonder about that. You bring up the anxiety when there's a looming tour. You've been really open about your own struggles with depression. And I wonder, when you run up against those sort of interior negative forces, the self-generated interior obstacles that we put up to keep us from being our best self or doing our best work or whatever, when you come up against those, what have you figured out as stratagem for getting beyond that?
Well, I think that as time goes by, you realize that everything will pass. You know, the anxiety at the beginning of a tour will make way for the satisfaction of having gotten a few shows under your belt. And you get into the routine of being on the road, and you enjoy making the money and everything. And so you can look, even with depression, you can, when you're in it, you can look for, you can look backwards and realize that the last one you got over and you got past it, and you will again. Yeah, I think and there are other little tools, you know, you figure out a way to do it that is a way that you try to minimize your own anxiety by, you know, having the people around you, whether it's a tour manager that you love, or, you know, if you have a good dog sitter, or, you know, if you have a partner, make sure the partner's got everything he or she needs back at home. You know what I'm saying? You just realize that the bottom line is you have to work. Everyone has to work. We have to work. So you just have to stop complaining and get on with it. That's the bottom line, really. You stop whining. You grow up. We grow up. We become adults. And we just have to do the job and shut up about it. Stop whining.
It's so funny when you said you have to work. When you first said it, I heard you saying like that this is sort of the thing that solves the problems is making the music or getting out and doing the thing that you are sort of meant to do is what helps move you past it. But what you're saying is you don't have a choice. So you might as well.
It's both though, because the funny thing that's been happening to me lately is that I'm realizing, like, I'm finally kind of realizing that I've made a lot of really good songs. Like, I don't think I ever really realized it until now. I was always striving all through the years. I need to make a better album. I need to make better songs. I need to sing better. I got to play the guitar better. And now I'm taking a step back and realizing that I've actually done a lot of really good stuff. There's a lot of great songs and guitar work and singing, and I'm proud finally. And I'm appreciating playing more than ever. I think it's less of a slog. Once I get up there on stage, I'm feeling like more proud than ever and more appreciative of the opportunity to get up and play for anyone. You know, the opportunity that the fact that anyone is still there in the audience is like an amazing, wonderful, beautiful thing. And so yeah, that's part. Yes, I have to work, I have to make a living, but then I get to work at playing this wonderful, magical music for people, with people.
That's great. Yeah, and that's such a big part of it too. I love that it comes up over and over, and what you've been talking about today is sort of the other people element of it, because what you do, and you know, I guess what we do in general, is so collaborative, and that's one of the biggest joys of the job, right?
Yeah. And about the work thing, do you know Matthew Cause?
Mm-hmm.
Not a Surf. My friend Matthew Cause from Not a Surf was we made this collaboration a while ago called Minor Alps.
Yeah.
And he was talking about how he travels a lot. Obviously he's in a band and he has a home in England. And he was talking about being in airports and going through customs, and customs agents would ask him, "What's your occupation?" And he was saying that it took him a long time to be able to say a musician with confidence, like to believe, like, yes, I'm a musician. That's my job. That's who I am. And it took him a long time to get to the place where it didn't feel funny to say that and mean it. But he was owning it after a long time. And I can really identify with that feeling. Like, it's because you feel it. Illegitimate. And maybe it's because of our era coming up in the 90s, and when mm-hmm. people labeled us as alternative rock, which was kind of a silly term, but or college rock. And I guess maybe a lot of us felt illegitimate in some way compared to the people who are having massive mainstream acceptance. I don't know.
And also, I mean, that punk rock ethos that we all have sort of had to deal with. God, I remember years ago, there was a band. I think it might be the Long Riders that my bass player Murray now plays bass in, that did a commercial. No, it was the Del Fuegos. That's what it was. There's an LA kind of early Americana band, and they did a commercial for Bud Light.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Everybody I knew was like, sellouts. It was so disgusting that they did that. And it was just such And it's so funny that we have always vilified ourselves and each other and anyone that does what we do, if they have any success. I remember I imagine Matthew has spent a bunch of his life trying to deal with the Elektra Records turning the song popular into the hit that it was. We were label mates at the time. And I remember thinking, like, oh God, what a great thing. What also what a weird, tricky, messed up thing he's got to do.
No, there was this whole thing we all had to grapple with. You know, we can't sell out. We're not going to be sellouts. And it was really big. It was really important not to compromise our integrity in any way. And then I really think the Del Fuegos were kind of ruined by that ad. And it's really sad.
Yeah.
It really, really, really hurt them, hurt their reputation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think today any band would jump at that chance for that kind of synergy, or whatever they call it, branding.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Branding synergy. But I, you know, I still think about this a lot, and integrity, quote unquote, integrity was always really important to me, and it still is. But people laugh at me now when I talk about artistic integrity, because it's kind of doesn't matter anymore to a lot of people. It's not even an issue.
Yeah, they're like, but how do you get your dance to TikTok viral? I mean, yeah, it's that was such an old person thing I just said. Yes, it's tricky. And none of us have a freaking savings account or health insurance. And here we are.
Yeah, like we sort of had to figure out how to do the adult things. It took over a long, long period of time, you know, because we were trying not to sell out.
I know. Okay, so I wonder if you were, by the way, I feel like you've shared so much great wisdom and insight, and I really appreciate your sort of vulnerability and willingness to think about these topics in a deep way. I wonder if you were to try and sort of distill some of this wisdom you've been sharing. Imagine a 21-year-old version of yourself in today's world, and you encounter this 21-year-old you, and what advice might you give her?
Oh, seems like it's a much more complicated situation that we're all in now, with the bottomless depths of all the World Wide Web and all that stuff. It's tricky. I guess like I would just go back to listen to your instincts, trust your instincts. Don't push them away. Your instincts have knowledge, you know, and they might be whispering, but try to listen. That's what I'd say. And also, don't be afraid to say no, because for a long time I didn't know how to say no, you know, to people. And just don't be afraid to say no and trust your instinct. I don't know if that's practical advice, but I kind of wish someone had told me those things very clearly back in the early days.
It's great. I'm glad you said that about instincts, because I feel like that's what musicians, or maybe artists, I don't know, but I feel like that's what we have, because everything we do is just on the fly deciding between chords or lyrics, or, you know, just like it's all these things where we have to make the decision in the moment, and it's all driven by instinct, and that's our superpower, maybe.
Yeah, definitely. And that's where it all comes from, and that's where really important decisions are made, which often don't even feel like decisions because they're just instincts, you know, like, no, don't do that. Yes, do that. And there are always a lot of other people weighing in and giving their opinions. And you have to be able to understand what's going to work and what's not going to work, and not listen to someone just because he's maybe some kind of an authority figure or has some kind of knowledge. Because no one knows everything, and you know certain things. Every person knows certain things are true for himself or herself, and you gotta just hold on to that, the truth, your own truth.
That's great, and it's incredibly useful. I'm really glad you said that. Well, listen, thank you so much, Juliana, for taking the time to talk to me and for being willing to, you know, go there and talk about all this stuff. I really appreciate it. And I look forward to this solo record that you're working on right now. Let's see how it turns out.
Yeah, it's gonna be a journey. I'm on a journey right now.
I love it.
Thanks for talking to me, and thanks for letting us do it without video.
Oh yeah, of course. thank you so much.
All right. Thank you so much for listening to Wheels Off. Please be sure to rate and review the show on iTunes. That helps us appear higher in the search results and lets other folks know that it's a cool podcast to listen to. Also, as the kids say, don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or anywhere else that you listen to shows like this so that you never miss an episode. This has been Wheels Off, and I'm Rhett Miller, encouraging you to create every day. Thanks, y'all.
Osiris. One Hit Thunder is a podcast where we both celebrate and have a good laugh about bands and artists that had just one hit that we all know. Each week, we're joined by a guest from the world of music or comedy to learn more than you ever thought you would about some songs that you can't forget. And we decide if they brought the one hit thunder or were nothing more than a one hit blunder. Look, if you listen to the show, you're probably going to laugh, and I guarantee you're going to crush next time the bar has music trivia. Tag Team, Jane Child, Meredith Brooks, Looking Glass, Sean Mullins, Eiffel 65, EMF, Crash Test Dummies, Crazy Town, Chumbawamba. We have hundreds of episodes in our back catalog and a new episode each week. So pass the Dutchie, make sure you're connected, and subscribe to One Hit Thunder wherever you get your pods.